I have the pleasure of introducing Pam Zeitlin, who is my boss, and it is Boss's Day, so thank you for coming. She's going to talk about other targets besides CFTR that may be potential targets, in a talk that's entitled, Who Needs CFTR? Alternative Activation of Other Channels. Dr. Zeitlin is a professor of pediatrics at Johns Hopkins and director of pediatric pulmonary at Johns Hopkins Hospital.
Thank you, Peter. So who really needs CFTR? Hopefully we'll have these other therapies that we can use for patients in whom we really don't know what their mutation is doing. Now, I think I'll just skip over this slide because you can read the competing interests in your book. And we'll start with a cartoon here to try to set the stage for comparing hydration of the normal airway with what happens in CFTR, which is basically an airway dehydration situation. And on both sides, you can see that there are cilia, which participate in clearing mucus particles and bacteria that are trapped in them from the lung. Mucus is generated primarily from the submucosal glands, and it floats up on the top of this airway surface liquid. And the composition and depth of that liquid has to be just right for this to work. And in order for the composition to be just right, we need a whole team of ion channels. Some of them are moving chloride, maybe another one is moving sodium, and there are other ones as well. In cystic fibrosis, we don't have CFTR, but CFTR is a master controller, as we're going to take a look at, and so the functions of the other channels can become impaired. In the CF situation, you have a hypertrophy of the submucosal glands. You have excessive production of airway mucus. It's got abnormal charges on it. It's sitting on a very dehydrated fluid layer, and it's very difficult to move compared with the normal airway. So the master controller of this is CFTR, which I put right here in the center of things. But there are other channels that CFTR enables. And one of these is the outwardly rectifying chloride channel. It's a simple chloride channel. It moves chloride in response to agonists, but it cannot function if CFTR is not there functioning normally. There's also other channels. Among them are the pH and voltage-activated channel, CLC2. And then there's the epithelial sodium channel, which requires CFTR to control it, to dampen its effect. So CFTR is enabling chloride to move out, and the epithelial sodium channel is reabsorbing sodium, and it becomes very excessive in cystic fibrosis. Now, the independent channels are the calcium-activated chloride channel and possibly also the CLC2. So let's look a little closer in the airway here. So CFTR is the cyclic AMP activated chloride channel, and it's next to the outwardly regulating chloride channel. And then we have the epithelial sodium channels, which are inhibited by CFTR. And we have P2Y2 receptors, which are responding to nucleotides like ATP, and they increase intracellular calcium, which activates the calcium-activated chloride channel. Now, here we go, back to cystic fibrosis. We'll just go over this again. As JP said, sometimes it helps to just keep looking at it in different ways. So now we have the situation where we don't have a functional CFTR in the luminal surface. And this leads to diminutions or even absence of chloride movement through the outwardly rectifying chloride channel. There may be less CLC2 activity as well. And there's excessive epithelial sodium reabsorption. So less chloride secretion, more sodium absorption, and you have a dehydrated airway surface liquid. Now, in cystic fibrosis, some of you may remember that the calcium-activated chloride channel, its activity can become very exaggerated. However, as was recently shown by Taryn at the UNC group, there are certain conditions in which that calcium-activated chloride channel doesn't work so well. And this is when levels of 17-beta estradiol are high, which occurs in certain phases of the menstrual cycle, and may explain why girls at the time of puberty and thereafter seem to have more trouble with their cystic fibrosis. So all of this together impairs mucociliary clearance. So what can we do? We have these other chloride channels, and could they be used as targets to move chloride through? And so there are several investigational molecules that are moving through the pipeline. The first one that I'm going to talk about is denufasol. And there's an ongoing phase 3 multinational trial that you've heard quite a bit about. The second one is MOLY-1901, or lanquvotide. I'm not quite sure how if I'm pronouncing that right. And right now, this is out of an effort with Canada, Germany, although it started in the U.S. And then I'm going to talk about something you probably haven't heard much about, which are the prostones. And they were developed to activate the CLC2 channel by a company that originated in Japan and has now moved to the United States. And there's both an oral formulation and an aerosol in development for the CLC2 channel. So denufasol, this is INS37217. It's a second-generation, chemically stable, selective P2Y2 receptor agonist. So first generation would be the ATP or the UTPs. And in this second generation, it's a more complicated molecule that has a longer half-life. It increases chloride secretion and mucin secretion and improves ciliary beat frequency and mucus velocity. It's metabolized, as I said, more slowly than the smaller molecules. And there's a lot of published data showing that it's safe in healthy volunteers and in patients with CF. So doses by aerosol between 20 and 60 milligrams are relatively well tolerated in CF patients who have mild lung function. So the caveat about all of this is the efforts have been aimed at studying denufasol in patients with FEV1s greater than 75% predicted. And there have been over 8 trials that have been successful that have moved this drug along its own pipeline. So TIGER-1 was the first multicenter trial, and it was 08108, and it met its primary efficacy endpoint, which was to look at change in FEV1 from baseline after 6 months of treatment when compared with placebo. And this graph shows you the significant effect on study drug here. It was a 45 mil treatment effect. And this was a real-world design. It was a broader population of patients on multiple therapies that were allowed that could at the same time have been improving FEV1. So this was a very encouraging trial, and we're all now in the middle of TIGER-2. It is still currently enrolling, although I think that the company has announced they're very close to meeting or finishing the enrollment. Multiple sites, there are over 100 sites around the world, including U.S., Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. And this is a 48-week placebo-controlled trial, and there is now an option for an additional 48-week open-label period with denufasol, which I think is really going to assist us in finishing the recruitment. Usual standard of care medications are allowed, as in a real-world design, except no hypertonic saline. Now, here's the word I can't pronounce, lanquvotide, or MOLY-1901. This is, excuse me, I need to go backwards. Hold on. Yep, sorry. This is working on the same calcium-activated chloride channel, but not through the P2Y2 receptor. Lanquvotide is a 19-amino acid polycyclic peptide. It's derived from bacteria. And it's been shown to increase intracellular calcium and then, of course, chloride secretion. And the way it works is it's thought to bind to the polar heads of phospholipids in the membrane and induce a change in intracellular calcium levels, and thus that is then sensed and it activates chloride secretion. We showed that direct application to the nose of normal or CF volunteers led to very sustained increases in chloride secretion, particularly at the higher doses of the range. It also has been shown to have a very prolonged half-life in non-human airways on the order of days. It is in an aerosol formulation and has since been tested and shown to be well-tolerated when given for 28 days. And there was a significant increase in this small phase 2 trial run by the company that's now called LantiBio, where there was an increase in FEV1 compared to placebo. And so this drug is still in the pipeline, and we're looking forward to phase 3 trials in the future. Now, CLC2 is another alternative chloride channel. It is not a calcium-activated chloride channel. CLC2 is one of a family of chloride channels conserved from bacteria all the way through mammals to man. This particular one is highly expressed in fetal lung. It's voltage-activated and acidic pH-activated. So the fluid of a developing fetal lung is slightly acidic. So it's expressed highly at a time when it could actually be open. And it's also volume-activated, so hypotonic stresses. And this is a little cartoon of its structure. And there's a class of molecules called the prostones that can activate channel CLC2. And it's been shown to be present in airway epithelium of mice and humans, so we can test these therapies in mice and humans. And we have recently demonstrated that you can activate the channel in the absence of CFTR in mice. Now, there are two potential agonists that could be used in cystic fibrosis. The first one, lubiprostone, the GIP people in the audience, if there are any of you, know as Amitiza. Lubiprostone is not absorbable. It's taken as an oral formulation, swallowed, and it activates the CLC2 that's in the intestine. Chloride secretion follows, and it's an FDA-approved drug for constipation, idiopathic constipation. Now, the only way you could use a non-absorbable molecule like this in the airway would be possibly to put it in directly by aerosol, but it wouldn't get absorbed. So that's not the way to go at this point in time. So there's another one in this class of prostones called cobiprostone. And cobiprostone can be given orally and is absorbed and metabolized. And it's been tested. It's still in an investigational molecule for the treatment of liver disease unrelated to cystic fibrosis. So some of you may remember that the CFTDN did a small phase 1, phase 2 clinical trial of cobiprostone in cystic fibrosis, where the primary outcome measure was looking for chloride secretion in the nasal PD, and also there was an effort to look at sweat chloride. That trial showed that the doses that were applied were low, and there wasn't really any significant absorption of this drug in cystic fibrosis or change in NPD. So the cobiprostone is under reformulation by Sucampo Pharmaceuticals, and we're hoping that that might get to clinical trial again for CF, because an oral treatment that could go to multiple organs in the body might really have an impact in this disease. Now, we promised we would talk a little bit about the sodium channel. The sodium channel is overactive when CFTR is absent. And the sodium channel inhibitors are not as far along towards the bedside as are the chloride modulators. And there are a couple. One is out of Novartis from the UK side, and this is a protease inhibitor. So proteases can activate the epithelial sodium channel. So this is an inhibitor. And then Parion in the U.S. has two molecules. These are small molecular weight molecules that will inhibit the sodium channel. And they've been tested in cells and in animals, but are not yet to clinical trial in CF. The goal with sodium channel inhibitors is to dampen down sodium reabsorption so you get a better airway surface liquid depth. And this is the goal. The goal then would be to improve mucociliary clearance. Shorter-acting sodium channel blockers have been tested in CF. You all may remember more than 10 years ago a phase 3 trial of amiloride by inhalation. Amiloride is a very short-acting sodium channel blocker, and it in phase 3 was not effective. And if you combine this a small or a short-acting sodium channel blocker with some other therapy, it can actually interfere with that other therapy and can even cause bronchospasm or declines in lung function. So we have to start to be very careful when we think theoretically about combining investigational agents. Longer-acting sodium channel blockers might be more desirable in CF, but these are still under evaluation. All right, osmotic agents. Everybody knows about hypertonic saline, and I think a lot of us believe that it's very effective in CF, and it's been rapidly embraced in the U.S. by CF care centers. The idea is that you're inhaling by aerosol sodium chloride, and that's this, these little red circles that I've drawn here, and they're depositing in the airway fluid, and then water is drawn through osmotically, and that will increase the depth of the airway surface liquid, and now when you cough, you'll be much more effective at mucociliary clearance. It has been shown to restore mucociliary clearance and be very safe, and currently is under study in younger patients now. It's under study in CF infants in the ISIS trial. But what's very interesting about hypertonic saline is that it works for a fairly long period of time after you've inhaled that dose. And that's very difficult to explain. If the only way that it's acting is as an osmotic agent and it's just salt, which the body can certainly get rid of very quickly, then how do we explain the evidence that it's very active in improving mucociliary clearance for hours after the treatment? And the latest research is pointing to the fact that there are sensors of salt by the airway that then go ahead and change gene expression, such as down-regulating molecules like the epithelial sodium channel. So I think there's a lot still to be learned about why something as simple as hypertonic saline might be a really effective treatment. Another agent to use as an osmotic agent to improve airway surface liquid depth and clearance is a simple sugar mannitol. So the inhaled mannitol or bronchitol is now provided for investigation in a dry powder formulation. And its rationale, or it's thought to work by hydrating the lung and improving MCC, just like hypertonic saline. But it's more slowly permeating. It's a relatively higher molecular weight than salt. And it's longer lasting. It requires larger doses. It's being formulated as a very unique dry powder, and there's a device that's very unique just to this inhaled mannitol, and it has a requirement that you put in multiple capsules very rapidly, one after another into the device, and inhale this series of capsules twice a day. So there is an ongoing phase 3 multinational trial that we're participating in, and it's achieved its recruitment goal as of September 09. There's also another phase 3 trial run by Pharmaxis for use in bronchiectasis not due to cystic fibrosis. So the companies and the physicians are looking to see whether this effect is not unique only to cystic fibrosis. All right, so we've talked a lot about different strategies. JP was talking about correctors, potentiators, stop-go-don, translators. I'm talking about alternative chloride channels and sodium channel blockers. How are we going to put it all together with the already complicated regimen of treatment for CF patients? The first, you know, new drug ever approved for CF was this rhDNAs. What are we going to do? How are we going to combine these treatments with something that we know works? So, for example, we're already facing that. Many of our patients take rhDNAs by aerosol, Toby by aerosol, and hypertonic saline by aerosol. And for many of us, what we prescribe as a typical sequence is to start first with a bronchodilator to open up your airways, and particularly if you happen to have reactive airways, to get them ready to take these molecules. Then give the rhDNAs. That helps you cough and expectorate and thin the mucus, and then give the inhaled antibiotic, Toby. Now, so how is this all going to work if we're also going to add in an aerosolized activator of P2Y2 receptors, or one of CLC2, or maybe even both? Because of a little of one and a little of another, why wouldn't it be synergistic? So all of this is going to have to be studied. What we do know is the effect of rhDNase in combination with some of these other novel therapies that are already moving into phase 3, that is under study. And so I just have a list of references here that I believe are in your booklet, so we'll move right through to the questions. Well, I think I actually am on time, and we have time for a few questions if anybody would like to ask a question. No, I don't think I meant specifically to target protease inhibitors, but I think in a lot of these aerosol trials, there's always a fraction of patients who have a little bit of cough and bronchospasm before they inhale it. Say, for example, even Toby, there's a certain fraction of your patients that do better if they take a bronchodilator first to try to relax their bronchial smooth muscle. Some of these alternative chloride channel agonists do the same thing, that work on the calcium-activated chloride channel. There's a small group of people that seem to have cough and a little more bronchospasm. But I don't think I was trying to target protease inhibitors specifically. Oh, okay. Okay, so Dr. Mogazel says the question is really, if short-acting sodium channel blocker amiloride causes bronchospasm, why wouldn't a longer-acting? A longer-acting may. They're chemically different. Amiloride is chemically different from a protease inhibitor, which is different from a small molecule. I don't know that the small molecule blocker would in any way cause cough or bronchospasm, but the longer-acting your agonist is, the better for the CF patient, because they won't have to take the drug too often. We all know our patients really have busy lives, and they count up all the minutes that it takes to do their therapies. Aerosol therapies do take a little bit of time. So I think I was just trying to make that point.
It looks like the effect is fairly rapid. I mean, after a period of 14 days or 28 days, you can see effects on chloride channel, effects on even pulmonary function. But when you look at some of the data on the P2Y2 agonist or denufosal, it looks like it takes months to potentially see some effect. What would there be this?
Right. I think that's a great question, actually. I think when you're looking at the master controller, if you can help that master controller get back to the cell surface and open, because it's only 10% open to start with, if you can open that significantly more, you may actually be able, because it's the master controller, to turn on the outwardly rectifying chloride channel down. All that hasn't been, clearly looked at in human volunteers, but because of that, because it's that controller and there's all these dominoes that are waiting to be fixed, you may be able to get that airway surface liquid hydrated for longer, and then eventually, hopefully, that turns into lung function. For the alternative chloride channel agonists, which are going to improve airway hydration, that's a step backward, I have to admit, even though I'm all in favor of doing this, bypassing CFTR. So we think it might take longer to see an effect. It's just from that hydrating portion of those other channels. Now, denufosal may actually downregulate the sodium channel to some extent. You heard Dr. Moss say that, so that could help. But I think it still needs more study. You're right. So it's So the question is, what class of drug is denufosal? It's of the nucleotide family, but it's a more complicated nucleotide than ATP, and its target is P2Y2 receptor. So the P2Y2 receptor is found on the apical membrane of the airway epithelium. It's also sometimes found on bronchial smooth muscle, and when you activate that, intracellular calcium goes up.
Just to comment on Beryl's question, I have another take on that, which is that it may be a factor of the route of delivery. So denufosal is delivered into the airway. To act, it's got to see that epithelial surface, get to that receptor.
True.
To get there, you've got to have a lack of mucus obstruction. If you give an oral drug like the VX770, it's delivered systemically, gets into the cell right away. And perhaps that's a reason for the different kinetics. That might be another explanation.
That's another good point.